From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed.
You know, people say, you know, this is your first movie. You got this tremendous ensemble. And the thing that I say is look what happens when you write real roles for Black people. You know, when you really give people substantial characters who feel real and who feel dynamic and who feel complex and nuanced and multi-layered and who have beginning, middles, and ends and real stories to tell. And not they're not just there to come out and say some expository dialogue and then they either disappear or die while the white lead goes to save the day.
You just heard Cord Jefferson. He's the screenwriter and director of the film American Fiction. Based on the novel Erasure by Percival Everett, American Fiction is a satirical examination of the ways in which Black people are often seen in very narrow and limiting perspectives in popular culture, as well as a complex and rich family story. Boasting a formidable cast led by Jeffrey Wright, American Fiction opened to critical acclaim and has gone on to be nominated for awards from nearly every major film guild and association, including the SAG Awards, BAFTA, the Spirit Awards, the NAACP Image Awards, culminating in 5 Academy Award nominations, including Jeffrey Wright for Best Actor, Sterling K. Brown for Best Supporting Actor, Cord Jefferson for Best Adapted Screenplay, and The Biggie, a nomination for Best Picture of the Year. Not a bad record for first-time screenwriter-director Cord Jefferson. I'm a longtime fan of Cord Jefferson's work in television. In fact, he was a guest on the podcast right before the pandemic. We talked about him writing for shows like Succession, Master of None, The Good Place, and most particularly, the groundbreaking series Watchmen, for which he won an Emmy Award. That conversation stayed with me because of his thoughtfulness, curiosity, and enthusiasm. So after seeing American Fiction, I was eager to speak with Cord Jefferson again about his film that had me laughing, crying, and thinking. He was gracious enough to join me. Here's our conversation. Cord Jefferson, American Fiction is based on Percival Everett's book Erasure, which was published in 2001. And I'm curious when you read the book and if there was this instant recognition that you wanted to make it into a film.
Yes, I would say that it really was almost instant. I would say within 50 pages, I was already reaching out to my manager and saying that I think I'd found my next creative project. Within, I would say, 100 pages, I was thinking that I might want to direct this, not just write the script. And then at a certain point, I don't even remember when in the novel, I started reading the novel in Jeffrey Wright's voice. That's how early I started thinking of Jeffrey for the project. I just started picturing him in every scene for whatever reason. So yeah, by the time that I was done with it, I almost felt jumpy. Like there was this kind of unstoppable energy in me. I was kind of bouncing off the walls because I felt so excited about this project, but it was still the holidays. And so I had to wait another couple weeks before I could even reach out to the author to ask for the rights. So it felt electrified in my hands when I was reading it.
What about the book spoke to you so deeply?
Everything, basically. So for people who haven't read Erasure, it's about this Black novelist monk who writes books that people think are not Black enough. And so to kind of fight back against them, and he tries to pull this prank in which he writes this very, very stereotypically tropey Black book, so to speak. And then it's full of, you know, violence and young Black men impregnating women and drug use what I think we all understand to be stereotypically quote unquote Black stories. And he writes this thinking that it's going to be this piece of performance art, a prank on the industry, and it ends up becoming his best selling book. And he exists between these two worlds for the story in which he resents that the book is becoming this huge bestseller while also requiring the money that the book provides. And so, you know, those kinds of conversations about the limitations people put on Black artists, the limited perspective or the limited imagination that people have about what Black life looks like, about what Black writers can do, that's stuff that I'd been thinking about since I was a journalist. I'd been talking with my colleagues about that all the way back when I was writing for newspapers. I started working in film and TV in 2014. So for 9 years before that, I was working as a journalist. And then when I started working in film and TV, I thought, great, this is the world of fiction. I can write about whatever I want to write about. I can write about Black people in space. We can write about Black people in the underworld. It doesn't matter. And lo and behold, it wasn't long before people were coming to me and saying, well, do you want to write a movie about slavery? Do you want to write a movie about young black person being killed by the police? Do you want to write a movie about a drug dealer? And it felt like, oh, even here, even in the world of fantasy and fiction, when we can write about anything we want to write about, there's no limitations. We are not beholden to reality. There was still this very limited perspective as to what black writers could do and what black life looked like. And so those themes were huge. Like, those really stuck out to me when I was reading the novel. And then on top of that, Monk has two siblings. I have two siblings. We have our weird sibling sort of trio dynamic, where sometimes we're closer, sometimes we're more distant. Monk has a very, very overbearing father figure. I have a very overbearing father figure. I love him very much, but he's admitted that he's overbearing. Monk moves home to take care of his ailing mother in the story. And I had moved home to take care of my ailing mother eight years ago. My mother died of cancer. And so the Venn diagram between my life and Monk's life was a circle the more that I read the book. And it just felt like I couldn't get over this idea that this somebody had written this book specifically for me. That's how it felt. It just felt like kismet in that way.
Well, American Fiction is your first film, both as a writer and as a director. And it's an unusual film. It's a pointed criticism of culture and at the way the ideas of race gets flattened in cultural institutions, as you just said. And it's also this very complicated family story. And I have to ask you about the process of finding backing for it. For you as a first-time writer and director of a film, and a film that isn't, you can't categorize very easily.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't easy, you know. Well, on the one hand, it was both easy and not easy, and I'll explain. And so on the one hand, this movie was made very quickly. The time between me picking up the book the first time, that was December of 2020, and the movie was in theaters as of December 2023. So altogether, that's 3 years from the very kernel of the idea to full execution of the movie being out, which is very, very fast, you know, in this industry. Some movies take 7, 10, 15 years to get made. And so I was very fortunate in that way. But the movie was made very quickly thanks to like three people, because the vast majority of people I took this script to passed. I would say that, you know, 98% of the meetings that I ended up having with distributors ended up with them saying, you know, this is one of my favorite scripts that I've read in years. Oh my God, I love this script. By that time, we had Jeffrey Wright attached. People were very effusive in their praise of Jeffrey. And then when I said, well, great, you love the script, you love the actor, can I get money to make the movie? It was just kind of crickets. There was sort of like, no, there wasn't really a major response there. And so I always knew that this industry was risk averse, but I think that was the first time that I understood exactly how risk averse the industry is and how afraid people are of trying new things and sort of taking risks on new artists. And fortunately, we brought the project to Orion, where Alana Mayo presides, and Alana Mayo is a black woman, and I think Alana Mayo saw something that other people didn't see, and so she believed in the film from the beginning and was just a huge advocate. So I was very fortunate to find Alana and a handful of others, you know, at T Street, the production company, and MRC, our financier, who really sort of believed in this and got it on its feet in a real way. Because without them, this town was pretty chilly in its reception to this material. So, yeah, I just feel very fortunate we got it in front of Alana and the rest of the team.
You also have the most extraordinary cast.
Yes.
For a first-time film, you have Jeffrey Wright, Tracy Ellis Ross, Sterling K. Brown, Issa Rae, Leslie Uggams, Erica Alexander. Mm-hmm. You have Keith David just playing this, you know, tiny, tiny little part.
Exactly.
How did you get them all on board?
You know, people say, you know, this is your first movie. You got this tremendous ensemble. And the thing that I say is look what happens when you write real roles for black people. You know, when you really give people substantial characters who feel real and who feel dynamic and who feel complex and nuanced and multi-layered and who have beginning, middles, and ends and real stories to tell. And not they're not just there to come out and say some expository dialogue and then they either disappear or die while the white lead goes to save the day. This isn't just sort of my assumption. This is what the actors told me themselves, you know, that these roles don't come along for them. I get a little emotional when I think about it, actually, that John Ortiz, who plays Arthur, Monk's agent, he's wonderful in the role. And he said a few weeks ago at a press conference, he said he read the script and then he called his representatives and he said, wait a minute, he wants me to play the agent? And his agent said, yeah. And he said, nobody ever asked me to just play the agent. He said, he's this idea that he was being asked to just play a guy, just a regular human being. And he said, and there was nothing in the story about, you know, his tragic circumstances of being sort of like an inner city Puerto Rican kid who had experienced violence or poverty. Like, none of that came to bear on this role. We just wanted him to be this lovely book agent who had this great relationship with Monk, who really wanted him to succeed. And they had this wonderful, rich backstory of supporting each other in their early days. Like, he said that he was amazed that somebody was offering him this part and that somebody had written this role. And we didn't have to talk about all of these sort of traditional issues that people might put in of identity and violence and tragedy just because he was a Puerto Rican man. And I think that to me was so meaningful to hear the actors say that. And I think that is what the actors themselves felt. Was Eric Alexander, who plays the love interest, Coraline. I was talking to Erica and she said something similar. She said, like, this is actually just feels so much like me. And Erica's first three roles when she was starting out in her career were a foster child, a prostitute, and a slave. And this happens for a lot of actors of color, that sort of like they're not really asked to just portray layered, nuanced, fully realized human beings. They're asked to portray these kind of caricatures of what life might look like and these very limited perspectives of what their lives look like. And so I think that's how we got it. It's just, I gave Black actors real roles. I think that is how I was fortunate enough to get the ensemble that I got.
Well, the movie certainly has publishing and movie making culture writ large, of course, in its sights. And you created a very pointed satire, which isn't easy because it also needs to stay grounded. How did you manage that balance?
It was a process, you know, so you try to find it in the script stage. From the outset, before I even started writing the script, I knew I wanted to make something that felt satirical but not farcical. That was always my goal. I watched some satire movies before I started writing, and I think a lot of satire, intentionally or unintentionally, becomes farcical. Sometimes it's a directorial decision, and sometimes I think that it gets a little too unwieldy for the creators, and it becomes farce. And I wanted to avoid that because I think that this is a story that could actually happen in the real world, and I wanted to acknowledge that and sort of in the creation of the film. And so I tried to find it on the page. You know, they say you make a movie three times. It's in the writing, it's in the shooting, and then it's in the editing. So then we tried to find it on set, and sometimes things got a little too dark, sometimes they got a little too light, and we had to rein it in. But we really, really found the tone of the film in post. It was that was the place that we were able to really refine it, sand down the edges, cut the stuff that was too broad comedically and started to feel silly, cut the stuff that got too dark and started to feel like, well, it's hard to pull out of this dive that we're in to sort of move on to something else. And so that's where we really refined it and sort of found this balance between the humor, the pathos, the balance between, you know, the family stuff and the professional stuff. That all really sort of came to be in the edit. I had this wonderful editor named Hilda Rasula, who really, really helped me balance those things and really helped me find the tone of the movie. There's some really, really great stuff that we left on the cutting room floor. Really great stuff. And I would watch it and I would say, this is really great, but this isn't the movie. This is really great for a different movie. That's really where Kill Your Darlings comes to bear, is that you need to look at something and say, yes, this is wonderful, but this is wonderful for a different project. This is not wonderful for this project. And so that's where a lot of the stuff ended up getting cut, was like, this is great, it's just not the movie that we are making.
Well, within the satire or surrounding the satire, I mean, enmeshed in it, is this rich, complicated story of Monk's family life and issues amongst siblings and an aging parent. And they're all very successful professionally, but 24/7 care is an expensive proposition. I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're laughing about the satirical professional side of things. And at the same time, our hearts are just so moved by this family.
Yeah.
So again, you're blending not just satire and a family story, but the professional and the personal too.
Yeah, and I think that that's important. You know, my favorite movies are ones that feel like life. And life is neither comedy nor tragedy. It's neither professional nor personal. It's all of these things. It's everything at once, right? It all comes at you at once. Yeah, and you need to juggle these things. And that's what sort of Monk is doing. Monk is living a complex, difficult, and funny, but also tragic life. And I think that as we all do. And so I wanted to make sure that this movie felt like somebody's actual life. And there have been moments when my professional life has been chaos and I need to deal with that personally and vice versa. And I think that I wanted to reflect that. One of the sort of important things about his story was to show the fully realized breadth and depth of Black life. And so to do that, you really have to explore every facet of their lives and to acknowledge that this is a full human being, that these are full human beings. And, you know, just on a technical writing level, I also think that the family stuff really helps ground the film. A lot of people tried to convince me to cut out some of the family, a lot of the family stuff. You know, for instance, Lorraine and Maynard, that sort of love story, the romance that blossoms in the film.
And Lorraine is the longtime housekeeper for the family.
Yes. A lot of people read the script and said, well, why do you need this? You know, these are ancillary characters. This is a tangent. Who cares if they get married? It's going to be expensive. It's going to take more time. And I just, every time I heard that, I was just like, absolutely not. There's no way I'm getting rid of those characters. I don't care if you think that they're ancillary. The intention is to show the diversity and sort of like reflect the fullness of Black life. And to me, to limit the character of Lorraine to just the housekeeper who comes out and says some exposition and then disappears into the background while everybody else does their thing. I know that most movies would treat Lorraine like that. I know that the vast majority of films would treat this housekeeper character as if she was just there to maybe come out and say a couple quick jokes and give some exposition and then go away. And I felt like it's important to the film and it's important to me to not make that exact same decision, because I know that that's the decision that a lot of directors would make. And so I felt like that stuff really grounds the satire, right? I think that it allows us to be funny and to have these really funny comedic scenes, but then also follow them up with things that end up grounding it immediately thereafter. And so that it doesn't feel like, again, like the entire story is collapsing under the weight of the comedy and it's becoming slapsticky and silly. Again, it's satire, but not farce.
Well, that's actually one of the things I appreciated so much about the film, is that the characters you created, even the smaller characters, just seem so full. Even though they have very little screen time,
yeah,
they're really realized. And Myra Lucretia Taylor, who plays Lorraine, for me was a beating heart of the film.
Absolutely.
And I could look at that face forever.
Absolutely. And Jeffrey says, you know, I don't know if you remember when he walks into the house and you hear her sort of like squeal with delight at seeing Jeffrey.
And that's when Jeffrey, as Monk, is returning to his childhood home after a considerable absence.
Yes. That was the first scene we shot with Myra and Jeffrey and Tracy. And Jeffrey said that as soon as he heard her voice, he said he just felt like he was at home. He said it was such a huge moment for his character walking into that house, because that's the first time we were shooting in that house too. He said, as soon as I heard her voice, I just felt like, yes, I'm at home. This is so welcoming and warm. And this is the exact emotion that I wanted to feel in this moment. And so, yeah, she represents to me unconditional love in the film. You know, these are children raised in a house where the love was conditional. They were raised by parents whose love was conditional and who could be frigid at times. And so this is a person who's able to look at them as they are and meet them where they are in the world and love them no matter what. And that's deeply important to the story for me.
Well, Jeffrey Wright is such an extraordinary actor. And I really also appreciated how much space you gave that performance and let it really breathe. So there's so many close-ups. And he's one of those actors who can be completely still and still convey multitudes.
Absolutely. No, it's wonderful. I said that Jeffrey does stuff with his eyebrows in his movie that some actors can't do with their entire bodies. So he's just truly, truly brilliant. And that's something that I learned really quickly on set was, you know, I was like, I don't want to shoot this now like a traditional comedy. I don't want to edit this like a traditional comedy where we're doing fast cuts back and forth and you're looking at everybody saying their lines. That some of the best moments and the funniest moments to me in the film are when we just linger on Jeffrey's face and see his response to the punchline. It's sort of like, it's like the punchline is funny, but it's enhanced by Jeffrey's facial expressions and his response to the madness that's going on around him. You know, one of my favorite scenes in the film is that first scene when Jeffrey walks into the book festival event where Issa Rae's character, Santara, is reading an excerpt of her book. And Jeffrey says not a single word in that scene. And yet he steals the show in some ways just because he's so funny, just what he does with his face and just the acting that he does just looking around wordlessly is so phenomenal and so great and so funny, despite the fact that he's just standing there. It's amazing.
Well, I think an important moment in the film is when Monk has a one-on-one conversation with Santara, who, as you say, is played by Issa Rae, who's written this very popular book that seems to be conveying all the black tropes that mm-hmm. Monk is pushing up against. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting conversation, beginning with Monk being quite righteous about her book, which we might add he has not read.
Yes, exactly. I'm happy you caught that. Some people don't catch that.
But then he and we, the audience, too, I think, are schooled by her. Suddenly, she comes back at him.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more complicated than he was giving her credit for. And I think it's fair to say that the audience was giving her credit for.
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why I really love that scene. You know, Jeffrey and I, when we first set out to make the film, I had been thinking about this when I was writing the script. And one of the first things that Jeffrey asked me when we first met to talk about the film, he said, I just want to make sure you're not interested in making some sort of respectability politics, pull up your pants and behave in front of white people. And this is how you behave to be a good black person. This is the kind of art you make to be a good black artist. We never wanted the movie to be scolding. And so to me, it was very, very important to not make Santara into this one note villain and sort of like and have Monk be this righteous crusader. When I was reading the novel, I was really, really looking forward to this clash when we would see these two artists come at each other with their own ideologies about what it means to be a black artist and what it means to make black art. I was so looking forward to that, and it never came. So that scene is not actually in the novel. And so I was craving it so much that I knew when I sat down to write the script, I had to include it somewhere. And so what I really like about that scene that you're getting at is that the tables are turned on Monk in that scene. All of a sudden, Monk, who's so pugnacious, and he steamrolls his students, he steamrolls his colleagues, he steamrolls his family, steamrolls his girlfriend. He's just a very sort of combative guy who always manages to get the last word. And all of a sudden, here's this woman that you assume the entire movie is going to be the foe that our hero Monk comes in and needs to save. And in that moment, when you realize like, oh, she's a lot more thoughtful about this than we had considered before, and she's smart, and she's really given this some consideration. All of a sudden, when Monk feels the tables turn, some people in the audience are probably feeling the tables turn too. Some people in the audience have probably been lulled into this idea that she is this caricature and she's ridiculous and she's the villain. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, this becomes far more complicated than I thought. And she's far more complex than I thought. That to me was really, really important. A, just to sort of make sure that we weren't commenting on what art was good or bad, but B, just because I think that most arguments in movies need to be draws. That's sort of like how you make the most interesting scene. You need to come at it from, what would this person say to get me on their side? And I think it's important to make sure that everybody in the scene is smart and has good arguments. For this film especially, I never wanted it to feel like it was spoon-feeding you answers. I never wanted it to feel didactic. This is not an op-ed column. It is a movie that allows you to think for yourself. And so that scene was important to get to that point where it's allowing people to think for themselves.
For me, a similar moment in the film is when Monk is writing his parody book. And in Erasure, Percival Everett includes the parody that Monk writes.
Yes. The entirety of the novel is within the novel, yeah.
But you obviously can't do that in the movie. You chose a different way to convey Monk's book.
Yeah. So as a writer, I'm always very critical of writing scenes in film and television because, you know, so many of them are just, you know, some writer beating furiously at their keyboard and writing a mile a minute and then turning and chugging some black coffee and then getting back into it. And for me, writing has always been a practice of deep insecurity, of pain, of real frustration. And so I wanted to make something that A, sort of like actually reflected what the writing was to me. But then B, as you said, we have the entirety of the novel within the novel. And I knew that that's not cinematic and we couldn't understand the gravity of that. And so it was important to have a scene that had the same gravity and sort of had the audience leaning in the way that the entirety of that novel within the novel had me leaning in. And so what I came up with was manifesting the characters that Monk is writing directly in front of him in his study. And it's this great scene with Keith David and Oak having this mano-a-mano conversation directly in front of Monk in his study. And I think that it is performed so beautifully by those actors, and they brought such life to it. And it was such an interesting take. That was one of the scenes in the film where I really saw the power of acting, and it really, really changed how I considered that scene. I considered that scene initially to be one that was going to be very kind of broadly comedic. And then Oak and Keith David got in there and performed it with such subtlety and such intensity that it felt like, oh, this is what the scene should have been all along. And it is one of my favorite scenes in the film. And I think that, you know, a few people have told me that it's their favorite scene in the film as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting because my note is these actors are not playing this for laughs.
Exactly. And that is what's the fascinating thing about it, right? Is that when I wrote that scene, without giving too much away, you know, one of the lines in that scene is Oak saying, you know, I hates this man, I hates my mom, and I hates myself. And when you write that, you say, how can anybody say these words and it not sound ridiculous? At least that was my idea when I was writing it. And then the minute we started rehearsals, we didn't really have much time for rehearsals because we didn't have much money, but we rehearsed that one. And the minute we started rehearsing it, there was just a magic in the air. It was one of these things where people were running from all around set to try to get a look at what these guys were doing. And it felt like, oh, this is not ridiculous in the way that I thought it was going to be ridiculous. And that is even more powerful because it allows you to see the way that this book might become a bestseller. I actually think that seeing them do that really helped sell the idea that this book becomes a hit, because you see, you know, with the right shading, you can see that somebody might go, oh, you know, this maybe this is good. And that I think added so much to the story that I hadn't even considered when I was writing it. It really is a sort of like an interesting glimpse at what actors can bring to a scene that you're not expecting.
Exactly. Exactly. And it also makes us understand why Coraline, Jeffrey Wright's girlfriend, played by Erica Alexander, who's not an idiot by any means, actually likes the book.
Exactly. And it's also, if you're paying really close attention, you're seeing that some of the demons that Monk is exercising in that writing, you know, he says, well, I'm just writing this as a goof. But the issues that Monk has with his father, it's a scene in which a young man is dealing with his father, right? And so you're realizing that as much as he's saying, like, this is pointless to me and this is stupid, he may be fooling himself when he thinks that he's not actually putting some of himself in this narrative.
I promised I would only keep you for 30 minutes, so this is my last question, and that is, this has been such a success that it has to be so gratifying. Are you focused now more on film, especially having met with such great success with your first one?
Yeah, you know, I always want to write TV, and in fact, I'm still contractually obligated to write TV for the next year and a half or 2 years. So I'm going to keep making TV, hopefully well into the future. But that being said, there is really something that I really loved about making a film. I really loved the finality of it. I really loved sort of just being able to tell this condensed story and say, like, here it is and it's done and we're moving on. I really loved the camaraderie of just being on set. I really enjoyed that. You know, TV writing is wonderful. I love it. But, you know, you got soft hands in TV writing. A lot of it is driving onto a lot and sitting in an air-conditioned room all day and then having fancy salads delivered to you at lunchtime and then going home at 6 p.m. and you're done. And you email in your script and and you move on from there. And then whoever's directing the episode directs the episode. This was an experience in which, you know, you're sitting there at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday night. It's cold out. It's raining. You've still got a scene to shoot, and people are miserable and want to go home, and you're tired and you're hungry. But you're out there with 60 other people and you're building something together. And there is something really, really special about that, that collaboration and that support that you have and the camaraderie that builds. I really loved that. And I'm never going to let that go. I want to do that as much as they'll let me.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it. Cord, thank you for giving me your time. Thank you for this wonderful film.
No, thank you.
And these wonderful performances.
Yes, thank you so much.
And congratulations on all of the nominations the film has gotten.
Thank you. I am so thrilled for these actors. I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud of everybody who worked on the movie. And thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
That was Cord Jefferson. He directed and wrote the screenplay for American Fiction, which has been nominated for 5 Academy Awards. If you're interested in his thoughts about writing for television, particularly writing for the series Watchmen, listen to my 2020 conversation with him. We'll have a link in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.